Bonjour and welcome to the Good Life France podcast, everything you want to know about France and more. I'm Janine Marsh. I'm an author and travel writer. And though I was born in London in the UK, I now live in a tiny village in the far north of France with 60 animals, maybe 61 soon as we're getting another dog. Oh, I dread to say it, but yes, we may be getting yet another dog to join our naughty Labrador puppies, Ronnie and Reggie.
Nice. Congratulations, Janine.
Thank you.
And bonjour, I'm Olivier, but usually English-speaking people call me Ollie or Oliver. It's easier, probably. I've lived in Paris for 13 years and then moved to London, where I still am today, 20 years later, in September this year, actually. So I suspect that Janine knows more about France than I do nowadays. But when you are born French, you stay French forever, wherever you are. And that is that certain je ne sais quoi that French people have that I am bringing here in this podcast. Now, what's on the menu today, Janine? What are we going to be talking about in what is actually the 15th episode of the Good Life France podcast?
Marvelous, magnificent, and mesmerizing monuments of France. That wasn't easy to say. That's what we're going to be talking about. The biggest, the best, the strangest, the quirkiest, the history, the legends, and the fascinating facts from the Eiffel Tower to the most incredible palace in France.
The Good Life France podcast. Everything you want to know about France and more with Janine Marsh and Olivier Geoffrey.
Okay, let's start with France's most visited monument, the Eiffel Tower. And not just France, it's actually the most visited pay-to-enter monument in the whole world.
And beyond, Janine, if aliens visit the Earth, they will definitely want to go to the Eiffel Tower. I am sure of that. That's a classic.
I am sure you're absolutely right. Aliens listening out there, get your tickets, though, before you go to the Eiffel Tower, because otherwise you'll be in a long queue. So, the Eiffel Tower, named after Gustave Eiffel, whose company built it, which took little more than 2 years. It's an incredible feat when you think about it. And it opened to the public in March 1889. It was made to showcase French engineering, their whole know-how, their skills for the Paris World Exposition. The very first visitors were Buffalo Bill and the British royal family. I love that. I wonder if they went together, because I can just imagine that, you know, the King and the Queen walking along with Buffalo Bill. Must have been quite an interesting conversation, I should think.
Yes.
Thomas Edison, the great Thomas Edison, he visited it too. And Eiffel, he entertained royalty and celebrities in his apartment at the top of the tower, which is strangely still there. It's like a little wooden cabin, like a little chalet at the top of the tower. It's incredible, really, when you think he was sitting up there with all these people. They must have known straight away that it was going to be something really astonishing. But not everyone loved it. There were lots of artists and quite influential people who signed a petition to have the building stopped. That included Charles Garnier, who designed another Paris monument, the Opera Garnier, the Paris Opera House, and various artists and writers. And they got together and they wrote a letter condemning it. They said it was a, quote, giddy, ridiculous tower dominating Paris like a gigantic black smokestack, crushing under its barbaric bulk the Notre Dame, etc., etc. They called it a hateful column of bolted sheet metal. Well, thankfully, no one took any notice of them. The tower was an instant success. People thought this metal column, 7,300 tons of iron, 18,000 parts used to make a latticework tower held together by 2.5 million rivets. They thought it was astonishing, and they were right. For 40 years, it was the tallest man-made building in the world, and the views from its platform over Paris are still absolutely brilliant. I remember going up in the lift, because it got like a lift in one corner, and I think I was about 13 at the time, and I'm really frightened of heights, and I've got to say, it was terrifying, but really worth it, and it's certainly beats climbing up 1,665 steps to the top. A friend of mine did it a couple of weeks ago, and it was one of those really, really windy days when the rain was pelting down. She said it was actually quite terrifying climbing those stairs, but she did it anyway. And there's a reason it's quite terrifying, not just because the weather, you know, makes it a bit hairy, but on windy days, the tower actually sways up to 7 inches in the wind. Wow. You know, when I think about it, everyone loves it, and I really don't know what it is that makes us love it so much. I think maybe it represents like overcoming people's prejudices, the people who didn't like it, and doing something different. It represents genius, but more than anything, it's a symbol of Paris and France. I've been there and I, you know, I've seen it loads of times, and every time I see it, it still really gets me. But I've seen people see it for the first time and they just burst into tears. And then you stand there at, you know, dusk and the famous twinkling lights come on and you can just hear people all around you just go, oh, you know, it's like a collective sigh. And even the famously aloof Parisians are in love with the tower. It's very romantic. And you can actually have a glass of champagne up there as well. If you go up a couple of levels, there's a champagne bar. And it's really, really romantic. Certainly, the singer Mariah Carey thought so. She and her husband renewed their wedding vows up the Eiffel Tower about 10 years ago.
That must be a sign then.
Yeah, I think so. I think she knows romance, that's for sure.
Yeah. Paris is, of course, full of monuments. You know, the Arc de Triomphe, the Louvre Palace, the Musée d'Orsay, the Conciergerie, so many. And one of the most famous and talked about of them all is, of course, the great Cathedral of Notre Dame. I think many people will remember watching the news in April 2019, horrified at the fire. Almost $1 billion was pledged from around the world to restore this symbolic art of France and of French heritage, which used to be visited by 12 million people a year. That's a lot. The cathedral is made up of a mixture of architectural styles created over many years. The North Tower was, for instance, completed in 1240, but the South Tower wasn't finished for another 10 years. They look as if they match perfectly, but look closely and you'll see the North Tower is a little bit taller. The two towers were the tallest structures in Paris until the Eiffel Tower was erected in 1889. Building of the cathedral began in 1163 on top of the ruins of previous churches, and before that a Roman temple. Pope Alexander III attended the ceremony in which the first stone was laid. It was completed in 1260, almost 100 years after building first started, longer if you include the addition of the flying buttresses added in 1345. There are 10 bells at Notre Dame, all named after saints: Marie, Emmanuel, Gabriel, Anne-Geneviève, Denis, Marcel, Étienne, Benoît-Joseph, Maurice, and Jean-Marie as well. Most of those original bells from the cathedral were melted to make cannons during the French Revolution. New bells were then not installed in the cathedral until the mid-19th century. The South Tower is home to the largest bell, Emmanuel, installed in 1638. Weighing in at 13 tons, its clapper alone weighs 1,100 pounds.
It's just astonishing, isn't it? One of my best memories of Paris was on a really, really cold day. I was with my husband in Paris. We were just being tourists, and I love being a tourist in Paris. And we were sitting at a cafe just opposite the cathedral, and it was freezing, but we were sitting outside because, you know, you've got to sit outside drinking hot chocolate, steam rising off, and the bell started ringing. And honestly, it gives me goosebumps just thinking about it.
There you go.
Wow. Yeah, it takes me right back to Paris. That does, thank you.
In fact, there is a lot of work going on with the restoration to do with the famous sound of the cathedral. The French poet Victor Hugo said its sounds were filled with benediction and majesty that soothes the soul, the organ, the singing, the prayers, but the fire and destruction affected the acoustic, and specialists are trying to restore it. And that's a very difficult work to do. We shall see when it hopefully reopens to the public next year.
I really hope it's going to be ready. I mean, everything I read in the newspapers, the updates, looks like it will be, and it will be wonderful to see it again and be able to go in there. You can see it now. If you visit Paris, you can still walk around, but there's scaffolding up and it's, you know, you can't go in. So it will be really good to do that again. Do you know what? We could probably do a whole series on Paris monuments. And in fact, we are planning to do a Paris podcast very soon. But for now, let's move out of Paris and to the south of France, to a small town called Haute-Rive in the Drôme department, Auvergne-Rhône-Alpes. I have to say, it's hardly known outside of France. And actually, I don't even think it's that well known within France. Haute Rives, I can't say it as well as Ollie in French. I'm learning still.
No, Haute Rive is good.
Merci. There are around 2,000 inhabitants. So it's quite a small town. It's got a friendly little bar and a couple of restaurants. It's got a lovely, cozy bakery where they make the most amazing cakes. If you ever go there, don't miss it. And it has a few shops and a couple of B&Bs and a campsite. It's just a typically quintessential French country town. Quite tranquil, sleepy, really, even. But it has a most extraordinary secret. If you drive through the town, you probably wouldn't even know it was there. You would miss it, maybe, except there are a few signs. You go a stone's throw from the boulangerie onto the side street, and you will discover something really extraordinary. And stone's throw is a good pun because this is a palace, and it's built by hand from pebbles collected by a postman as he performed his delivery rounds. I honestly think this is one of the most amazing monuments I've ever seen, and I've seen a lot in France, but this one is so different. Ferdinand Cheval was born in 1836 in Drôme, and on his postal rounds, which he did on foot, 25 miles a day. Can you imagine that, walking 25 miles? Pretty much, I think, 6 days a week. He would look at the postcards that people sent from around the world, and he daydreamed about all these places that he never thought he would get to see. And in fact, he didn't get to see. He never left. And one day on his rounds, he tripped over a stone and he picked it up, put it on his pocket, and he didn't really think very much about it. But then he said when he got home, he thought, if nature is the sculptor, I will be the architect. Whatever it was that kicking that stone, tripping over it and putting it in a pocket, it just kind of kick-started a dream, and he decided to build a palace, a fairy tale palace. Then every day when he was delivering the post, he started filling his pockets with pebbles as he walked, and it became an obsession. And he got himself a little wooden barrow, which is still there. You can see it at the palace, like a really low down one. He must have been bent over with it. Goodness knows what it'd do to your back. But he had this tiny wheelbarrow made of wood, quite heavy as well, and he started collecting stones in the barrow. He was 43 years old when he started, and he was 76 years old when he finished. Cheval, he spent 33 years, 10,000 days, 93,000 hours, because he wrote it all down. Actually, he carved it on a piece of stone on the palace, building what he called his Palais Idéal, his ideal palace. Not only that, he did it at night after he finished work by candlelight. Absolutely amazing. It's an incredible, artistic, quirky, bit bonkers maybe, but totally beautiful palace with giants and animals, fountains and strange figures. It looks a bit like an Aztec temple or an Indian palace. I've posted a picture of it on Twitter the other day, and I said this was in France, and somebody said, "No, it can't be, you're wrong," because it just is so exotic and not remotely French. And all his neighbors thought he was a bit crazy, but he actually became famous in his own lifetime. Many artists visited, like Picasso, Salvador Dali. I think Picasso actually created a series of drawings in homage to this amazing creation and the dedication of a man who could just do this. And Cheval, when he finished it, it's quite haunting that he built his own tomb in the same style. And he finished it when he was 83 years old, and then he died the year after. And it's quite moving, really. And I find it absolutely incredible that he did this because I've got to tell you, I've been renovating my old farmhouse for 19 years, and his story is an inspiration to me. But I do hope it doesn't take me 33 years. What would your partner say, Ollie, if you were out the garden all night building a palace from pebbles by candlelight?
Well, she will not be impressed to start with. But she knows she's safe, I'm not a DIY person at all, and she knows that very well. So, my darling, don't worry if you are listening to this, that will never happen, and you know it. So, all good. There are many palaces in France, and at the complete opposite of the postman's palace, there is, of course, Versailles near Paris, world famous for its bling bling, as we say in France. When Louis XIV was thinking about how to create the most magnificent palace the world had ever seen, one that truly showed off its glory and absolute power, he can't have had any idea just how many people will tread in his footsteps and gaze in wonder at his legacy. The Chateau de Versailles is world famous, of course, but I promise you, nothing you see on the TV or in photos or wherever prepares you for the sheer absolute golden glitz and glamour of the real thing. 700 rooms, 1,250 chimneys, 67 staircases and 2,000 windows. The Chateau of Versailles is monumental, you guessed it, a colossus of a building. It was originally 6 stories high, but the top layers were leveled off in the 19th century after the French Revolution. A must-see.
It is. It's an astonishing place. I love the little stories as well. When I went there, they were doing some renovations on a room, and it's not just the bling, you know, the bling bling and the golden glitz of it all, but you actually see the bones of the palace as well. And there's all this beautiful wood paneling. And because they were renovating, I could see it. It was, you know, it was just plonked onto the wall. And they told me that in World War II, this beautiful ancient wood panelling was hidden in a coal mine in the Pyrenees to protect it. It's completely detachable, sort of like a, you know, like an ancient tongue and groove. It's astonishing, really, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And did you know that more than 1,000 fireplaces didn't make it warm at all? It was recorded that in the winter of 1695, the king's glass of wine froze on the table while he was eating his dinner. Imagine.
Wow.
In fact, dinner here was the problem. Hundreds of courtiers lived in little apartments at the palace, and they mostly didn't have a kitchen, so they had to send their staff out for food. And a sort of town of food booth grew around the castle. And the town of Versailles is even now known for having one of the best markets in France. Versailles is on the UNESCO World Heritage List, along with 48 more incredible sites, including the fortified city of Carcassonne, beautiful, Bordeaux's Port of the Moon, and the Palace of Fontainebleau, and the great Gothic Cathedral of Amiens as well.
Been to all of those, but I haven't been to all the sites on the list, but that is my mission. I'm sort of slowly working through 1, 2, sometimes 3 a year. I'm getting there. One of my favourites on the UNESCO World Heritage List is another Gothic marvel, the Palace of the Popes in Avignon in Vaucluse, Provence. I'd heard of the Palace of the Popes and I'd seen photos and I even knew a little bit of history before I went, but absolutely nothing prepared me for seeing it for real, you know, in person. I think I've been there 3 times now, maybe more. Every time, the sheer overwhelming size and the incredible history that, you know, took place in this palace in which the popes lived, I just find it absolutely mind-boggling. So a little bit of history. In 1309, Pope Clement V established a papal residence in Avignon, making this French city the capital of the Christian world rather than Rome. There's lots of reasons why, but mostly there were issues within the running of the Catholic Church in Rome, and the French king pretty much insisted that Clement, a French pope, stayed in France. After this, there were 7 more popes, and each of them elaborated and extended the building that was chosen to be their home. And in the end, it was like this soaring, majestic palace that we now see. There were a maze of rooms and chapels and courtyards and little gardens. They even had a little orchard they could reach from the Pope's bedroom. It's just astonishing, isn't it? It's like a pretty little garden now. And the 4th Pope, who was also called Clement VI, he bought the city of Avignon from the Countess of Provence. And then after this, all the cardinals started to build grand palatial mansions around the Pope's palace, and the old city of Avignon, to all intents and purposes, became an enclosed city, much like the Vatican in Rome. So these 7 official popes lived here until it was moved back to Rome in 1376. But the French, being contrary, as they can sometimes be, Ollie, they said, no, we want it to carry on here. So 2 what they called anti-popes, 2 more French popes, continued living in Avignon and trying to rule the Catholic Church for another 39 years. Well, meanwhile, they were also ruling from Rome, but in the end, the French contingent was forced to give up. And then the palace became just like a home for the legates of Rome, but no one put any more money into it, and it became quite dilapidated. And then Napoleon Bonaparte, who had a bit of a habit of taking old buildings and turning them into prisons and barracks for his soldiers, did just that. He actually turned the Palace of the Popes into barracks for his soldiers, and they put up makeshift beds in the huge halls, and bits of the building were destroyed because they put in false floors and stuff like that. But in a way, he also did a great favour because a lot of buildings, a lot of old buildings were just being knocked down all over France at that time. But because the soldiers were there, they kept it going. And actually, some of the rooms were untouched, like the Pope's bedroom with its beautiful frescoes and several chapels with gorgeous floor tiles. The kitchen is still there. I mean, the kitchen is amazing. It's massive. It's got this weird, weird, really tall chimney. And it's big enough that they, apparently they used to roast up to 50 oxen at a time in that kitchen. Their architecture is wonderful. And it is the biggest Gothic palace in the world, covering a whopping 15,000 square meters. If you do go there, I highly recommend you pop to the wine bar next door called the Carré de Palais, which is in an 18th century mansion, and it has a gorgeous terrace overlooking the Palace of the Popes, and it is the perfect spot for people watching, palace watching, and a glass of wine.
I love that Pope story you told just before, Janine. I mean, in a way, even the popes were demonstrating and striking a long time ago. That gives you an idea of the spirit in the country, right?
Yes, they were French popes and they were French all the way through.
Yeah, exactly. And the great thing about monuments in France is that the small ones are as incredible as the big ones. I mean, take the cemetery of Père Lachaise in Paris, for instance. It may sound odd, but this is a wonderful place to take a stroll and admire the mausoleums. More than 1 million people rest here, and some say it is the most visited cemetery in the world. The name of the cemetery comes from Père François de Lachaise, confessor to Louis XIV. At first, it wasn't a popular place to be buried, too far from the city centre, even when Napoleon Bonaparte tried to encourage people to choose it as their lasting resting place in 1804. It wasn't popular, just 13 graves or so at the time. So Paris officials came up with a sort of marketing strategy. They transferred the remains of the great writers Molière and Jean de La Fontaine here from their original graves. The public ceremony attracted the attention of other applicants. Then in 1817, the remains of Pierre Abelard and Héloïse d'Argenteuil were transferred and placed under a canopy constructed from fragments of a well-known Paris chapel. The couple were one of history's most passionate and romantic true love stories, and their 900-year-old love affair is known throughout France. So lovers or people searching for love at the time would leave letters under the canopy, hoping to find fulfillment for themselves. The romance eternally associated with Paris spread even to the graveyards. Père Lachaise Cemetery became popular at last. There are many beautiful mausoleums and gravestones lining the tree-filled avenues, and people visit from around the world to pay their respect to those who rest here, including Jim Morrison from The Doors, the band. His grave is always covered in flowers, and people used to have sex on it, as a tribute to Jim, but not everybody knows that.
I did not know that. That is proper creepy, actually.
Yeah, that's really creepy. And Oscar Wilde, whose gravestone is now behind a plastic cover because so many people left kisses on it, the stone started to deteriorate. Thousands of little monuments here, I'm telling you.
It's just a lovely place to take a walk as well. It's just such a peaceful place. And it's actually really popular, you know, for people to go and walk there. And you're right, thousands of statues and little monuments. One of my favourite statues, though, is the gilded Archangel Michael in its gravity-defying position atop the Abbey of Mont-Saint-Michel in Normandy. It's incredible. Mont-Saint-Michel is just majestic. It's one of those places, it gets busy. Its wiggly cobbled streets are covered by visitors, especially in the summer. About 2.5 million a year, I think it is, because it is one of the most popular sites in France. But it doesn't matter about the crowds because the magic still shines through. It's like a tiny town on a granite island cradled between the coast of Brittany and Normandy. And from the distance, it looks a bit like a sort of magical helter-skelter. It's got lopsided, half-timbered houses that lean against each other and wind their way around narrow alleyways, topped by this golden statue of Saint Michael. Victor Hugo, the great French writer, said the island was like the pyramid of the seas. And you can, when you're driving there, or if you're walking there and you see it in the distance, you can really see what he means. It's one of the wonders of the world, and it's attracted hordes of tourists since the Middle Ages. I just love to go there and be a tourist there. And I took my dad once. He didn't want to go. He was like, oh, no, another bloody monument. He said, well, he was a Cockney. So, you know, he said, and he really moaned the whole way there. He wanted to go and see all the D-Day sites. And we did go and see the D-Day sites as well. But I said to him, you've got to see Mont Saint-Michel because it's just extraordinary. But he did moan. And then when we walked through this great stone arched entry to the town, my dad stood there stock still, and the sight of all this monuments and incredible cobbled streets and everything, chapels and souvenir shops and cafes in medieval buildings, he was just blown away by it. And we walked up there and we went past this restaurant called Mère Poulade, which is very, very famous for its fluffy omelettes. They make them to a secret recipe that no one knows. Got to be really special omelettes because they're frightfully expensive. And they're cooked on an open fire in front of customers. And they've been doing it this way since 1888. We didn't go in with my dad, but I will go in another time because, I mean, there's just like a huge long list of fans for this place. Ernest Hemingway, Marilyn Monroe, and anyone who's anyone and goes there, goes to Mère Poulade. And I think they've actually got a little hotel as well. And there are several little hotels on the island, which is a great way to see it after all the coaches and crowds have gone. So we just wandered for hours on these little tiny streets, and then we stopped for lunch. And I have to say, if you ever go to Normandy, I mean, Normandy is like foodie heaven, and you better like butter if you go there, and you better like cheese, and you better like garlic, cream, and all sorts of things. Let's just say, if you go to Normandy, you're not going to be on a diet. And don't forget to pack your stretchy trousers. So we stopped at this little restaurant, and a lot of the restaurants and shops have little terraces out the back overlooking the bay. And this one had a lovely terrace, and it was a sunny day, and they brought out a cheese board. And just thinking about it makes me drool. They had like this ripe brie and smelly camembert, Livereaux and Pont-l'Evêque, heart-shaped Neufchâtel and pavé d'Auge, that all these local cheeses. My dad was a real cheese fiend, and he didn't know which one to choose. So I said to the waiter, you know, can you tell us a bit about the cheeses? I'm not going to do a French accent, but he was like, this one comes from a dairy farm in a sleepy village among the rolling hills. And I'm doing a French accent, sorry, can't help myself.
You can't help it.
And this one is one of the most creamy and delectable cheeses in the world. And this one is flavored with a little Calvados. And this one tastes of heaven. It's delicious. And it was like, he had this droopy moustache and he was rolling the words through his moustache. My dad was like, oh, yes, I have all of those. And I said, no, you're supposed to only have three slivers. But he's like, nope, I'm having a bit of everything. Obviously, after he'd eaten all these cheeses, could hardly walk, and he was getting on a bit. So we left him at the restaurant while we decided to climb to the top of the island, which is about 350 steps on this huge staircase. And we went up to the abbey, and it's hauntingly beautiful. I mean, it really, really is. And at the end of it, we went down and collected my dad, and he, by then, he'd fallen completely in love and, you know, not moaning anymore about going there. He just stood there and he said, this is one of those places you need to see before you die. It does. It gives me goose pimples when I think about it. And in fact, this year is the 1,000th anniversary of the building of the nave of the abbey. 1,000 years it's been there. And we have a fabulous article coming up in the next issue of the Good Life France magazine. And I'll tell you where to find that at the end of this podcast, okay?
Okay. Everyone falls in love with Mont Saint-Michel, but how about some really ancient monument, like the megalithic burial mound, the Cairn de Barnenez, is the oldest structure that is still standing in all of France. The Cairn de Barnenez was originally referred to as the prehistoric Parthenon by French author and politician André Malraux.
I love that France has such a diversity of monuments and, you know, ancient ones like this. There are prehistoric caves, there are grottos. I mean, there's the Lascaux caves in Dordogne, Chauvet in the Ardèche. I'm going to Marseille next week, and I'm going to go and try and see the Cosquer caves, which are replica caves to protect the ancient originals, which are in an underwater passageway. So, you know, much better to go and see the replica one. It's 37 meters under the sea, and it's filled with handprints and images that are 15,000 years old. If you think going to see a replica isn't as good as the real thing, let me tell you that the diver who discovered the Cosquer caves was called Henri Cosquer, and he discovered the caves in 1985. And then when he went to visit the replica caves, they said, "What do you think?" And he actually had tears in his eyes. He was so moved and impressed by what they did. So don't be put off by the fact it's a replica. Go see it if you go to Marseille.
Another magical place to see.
Absolutely.
Yeah. We could talk and talk about the monuments of France, and I'm pretty sure we will talk more on this in a new episode, as you said earlier. But it's a great way to explain why France is the most visited country in the world. When you add the number of visitors of each of those monuments, you get it. Ready? Got a question about France? Well, ask the experts. We reply to you in each episode. And we do it for free. But now it's time for the Q&A part of the podcast, when you ask the questions and we answer them. It doesn't matter what your question is, we'll see if we can help. So, Janine, what is our question today?
Okay, today's question is from Terry Unsworth from Australia, who asks, what's the best place to buy a baguette in Paris? He says, my partner and I have been dreaming of going to Paris for years and years, and this year we're going to do it finally. One of the things I really want to do is buy the most delicious baguette, but I don't know where to start. Well, Terry, luckily for you, we know just the place, don't we, Olivier?
Yes, yes. It's actually quite difficult because everyone has a favorite boulangerie in Paris and anywhere in France, really. Many people think that Eric Kayser is the king of bread, Eric Kayser. Others may think it's Maison Le Nôtre. And if you go to Paris, just ask a local. They will have an opinion for sure.
That's actually the same everywhere in France. Everyone has an opinion about where to buy the best croissant, where to buy the best brioche, where to buy the best baguette. And it's actually one of the ways that I made friends when I first came to France, because I just used to ask my neighbours and the locals, where should I buy these things? And everyone wants to share their favourite.
Exactly. But with Paris, it's a bit easier because we do know who is the official best baguette maker in Paris, because there is a contest. Of course there is. Each year in May, the week-long Fête du Pain, Festival of Bread, is held in Paris on the forecourt of Notre-Dame Cathedral. You can learn about bread and pastries, taste them all, and meet the greatest bread makers and pastry chefs. And there is also a contest for the best baguette maker in Paris, and whoever wins gets a contract to supply the Élysée Palace, nothing less, the president's residence, with baguettes every day. Last year's winner was Damien Dedin, who works at the boulangerie of Frédéric Comin, Rue Cambronne, in the 15th arrondissement.
Personally, I think Breadman, the man who delivers the bread to my little village in the middle of nowhere, northern France, he makes the best baguettes. If you're listening, Breadman, best baguettes in France, I promise you. And anyone wanting to go to the contest in Paris, it takes place in the middle of May, usually around 16th of May, which is the patron saint of Baker's Day, Saint Honoré in France.
This is the Good Life France podcast. Oh là là! Le podcast The Good Life France. It's almost the end already. Tune in for the next episode when we'll be talking about more France and fun stuff. Surprise.
Meanwhile, you can find me at thegoodlifefrance.com, where there are thousands of articles about France and all things French, from culture to gastronomy, history, and heaps more. And on the website, you can sign up for the podcast and our free magazine that I told you about earlier, where we're going to be writing about Mont Saint-Michel in the next issue. You can find that at magazine.thegoodlifefrance.com, completely free.
And you can find me at parischanson.fr, a unique radio station playing the French classic songs of the 40s, 50s and 60s non-stop. Basically, the Paris you love 24/7.
I listen to it all the time. But for now, it's au revoir from me.
And goodbye from me.
Speak to you soon.
The Good Life France podcast. Available on all podcast platforms. On thegoodlifefrance.com and on parischanson.fr.